We're discussing the subject of the reconciliation between Yosef and his brothers. And the whole story is extremely dramatic, as you know. It's one of the most dramatic stories in the entire Torah. Because usually the Torah doesn't go into those types of things. It's usually a very dry kind of a description. But in the story of Yosef and the brothers, we get much more emotion and drama. But perhaps the most emotional point of all is the point that everybody, when you hear, unfortunately we've all heard it already, you're not hearing it for the first time. Does everybody remember when they heard the story for the first time? They learned the story of Yosef and the brothers for the first time? Let's turn to Perek Mem Hei, where we read about the dramatic reconciliation that takes place between Yosef and his brothers. Of course, this is all a result of the last phase of the tshuva process that he put them through, which is fulfilled with the plea of Yehuda, and Yehuda is offered to put himself in the place of Binyamin and to be a prisoner for life in order to fulfill the vow he had taken to his father. The pickup is the initial impact, the initial moment of reconciliation, which is a very fascinating scene. Then in Pasuk, take a look at Pasuk Aleph in chapter Mem Hei. So this is after Yehuda has made his dramatic appeal to essentially it was really an appeal for mercy to the father. That was the whole essence of the appeal. That if you take the lad, then this will destroy father. So that was the essence of Yehuda's appeal. So it says that Yosef could no longer contain himself regarding all those who were in the room. He was just breaking down emotionally. He couldn't take it. So you see, even Yosef, we have this image of the great tzaddikim as being beyond normal emotion. It's not the case. And this was, he was overwhelmed. That's not the reason why he decided to call an end to it, as I've explained. The reason why he decided to reveal himself was not because of his emotions. He was in control of his emotions. So then he had everybody leave the room, and there was nobody with him when Yosef revealed himself to his brother. Of course, this had to be completely private. And then when everybody had left the room, he allowed himself to indulge his emotions. Pasuk describes that he came out with a great cry, and Egypt heard, and the house of Pharaoh heard. So apparently the people, although they didn't know the particulars, I maintain that Yosef always kept it a secret, the fact that he was sold by his brothers. And you wonder, because then all of a sudden Pharaoh finds out that his family has come down, and that's a different issue as to what he told Pharaoh. It's something of a curiosity, because Pharaoh, I'm sure, would be curious as to what's going on here. Well, how come your family all of a sudden came down? How come you said, well, what's this? There's a missing piece. There's a big gap. In my opinion, Yosef kept this a secret and never let the Egyptians know that the brothers had actually sold him as a slave. And so if that's the case, what did he tell Paro? In my opinion, he told Paro the same thing he told the Sarah Mashkin, the butler, when he asked the butler to intercede for him. Kiguno Gunafti. He would not reveal the truth. He said, I was kidnapped as a youngster. And everything fits in the way that he structured the strategy of getting Pharaoh to agree to let them settle in Goshen. Basically, the excitement as far as Egypt is concerned is that Joseph, who had been kidnapped as a youth and sold as a slave, had been dramatically reunited with his family. Beyond that, the circumstances he would not reveal. And that makes perfect sense. Because, you see, Pharaoh had tremendous enthusiasm for bringing them all down there. He thought that it would be a great thing for the country. Of course, if he had known the truth, that they had actually tried to kill him and they sold him as a slave, and that would have made them look so terrible. Why would Pharaoh want these people? I mean, there'd be something really sick about this family. So Yosef would never reveal that. As far as Pharaoh, as far as anybody else, that's why he emptied the room. There were no Egyptians. The Egyptians heard that something exciting was going on. That's what it means, that the sound spread throughout Egypt. And then the word went out that Yosef's family has come down. They assumed that it was all some type of a coincidence, an accident. We're going to read Pasuk Gimel, where it says that Yosef said to his brothers, I am Yosef. Ha'od avi chai, is my father still alive? Lo yachlu echav lano so-so. And the brothers couldn't answer him. Ki nirol mipanav, because they were totally thunderstruck. Bahala, tried to translate it. It was it's sort of like in a state where you almost like hysteria. Now the plain meaning, you don't have to go very deeply to understand their reaction. Although there are medrashim, that there's a deeper level to their reaction. But on the surface, it's enough to strike anybody with shock. Shock is, the best word. You'd just be shocked. The fact of the matter, this was the last thing in the world that they'd ever expected. And there is a medrash, you know, that says that they came, that's how Yosef accused them of being spies, because they entered at 11 different points of entry. And then they all got together, so Yosef used it against them and said, oh, you're spies, because if you're one family, why'd you enter in separate places? But there is a medrash that says that one of their objectives was to search for Yosef. I may have mentioned it. And where were they searching for Yosef? They were searching in the houses of prostitution, in the so-called red light, the districts. No, because they thought that he'd be totally destroyed. But you see the importance of a person's self-image. That once a person is broken psychologically, then he loses any self-esteem, so that's it. That's why he lives a life of degradation. People live lives of degradation because they're basically living in accordance with their self-image. Maybe it's not conscious, but it's unconscious. So it's a powerful thing. So of course, to then have been subjected to all of this torment, they thought it was a punishment for the sin they had committed, but never in their wildest imagination. And it's a good thing that nobody there had a heart condition, because that's kind of shocking. He dropped it on them. The question has been raised, of course, a very good question is, it's illogical for him to ask, is my father still alive? Because it's absolutely clear that he knows that his father is alive. He has to know that. When they came down with Binyamin, in accordance with his request, so he, again, was playing mind games with them. He was setting them up. And he was favoring Binyamin, as we explained. He wanted to recreate the old situation to see if they'd overcome it. But the first thing he asks them when they gather together is, Hashalom, he asks about his father, he inquires about his father. That's in Chav Mem Gimel 43:27. As soon as Yosef comes, he asked how they were, and he said, Hashalom, Avichem Azrakein, Asher Amartem. How's the father? He wanted to know. He knew his father was an old man. He had to know. That was crucial to everything he was doing. So he had to know if Yaakov was alive and well. How's your father doing? How Denu Chai? Is he still alive? This is a legitimate question because Yosef did not know. He could have died in between. Yes, your servant, our father, is doing well. Odenu Chai, he's still alive. And they bowed out of graciousness that he was so concerned to ask about the father. So clearly Yosef knew. There was no reason in the world why Yosef would have thought they were lying. Moreover, the entire appeal of Yehuda was what? Was based upon the fact that please take me, it might all kill my father. If Binyamin doesn't go back, I'll kill my father. So it's obvious that, clear, no doubt, that he's alive. So what is he asking? Is he still alive? That's a question, and all of the commentators address that question. There are some commentators that switch it around and say that it's not really a question. It's really just it's a statement of amazement. Is my father, in the sense, not as a question. He's like expressing his gratitude that he can't believe it. My father is still alive. But that, I think, is difficult. Honestly, it's difficult. And there's an interesting chazal. Rabbis say, actually, it's Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, say that from this behola, from this shock of the brothers, you see, the brothers were shocked. So we all can learn a lesson concerning the Day of Judgment. We can all learn a lesson. As Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, woe unto us concerning the Day of Judgment. Woe unto us concerning the Day of Rebuke, of Tochacha. Why? For if when Yosef said to his brothers, I am Yosef, they couldn't answer him, when God will stand in judgment over us, how much more so? That is to say, that if the brothers were shocked, and they couldn't speak because of the rebuke of Yosef. So how much more so when we are going to have to confront the rebuke of God? That's what they say. But of course, there's a question on that. And the question is, but Yosef didn't rebuke them. There's no, if you take a look at the pasuk, he didn't rebuke them at all. He just said, I am Yosef. My father's still alive. And yet the rabbi saw from that he was actually rebuking them, and on a deeper level, that's why they couldn't answer him, because they were rebuked. Now there's two levels. On the plain level, they couldn't answer because of the ordinary shock that anybody would feel to be subjected to this type of a thing. But then there's a deeper level. And the deeper level is that somehow or other the rabbi saw in the question an element of rebuke. Even though Yosef overtly never chastised them. And then he goes on to the contrary. To the contrary, what he says from that point and on, that he says, do not be concerned and don't be upset with yourself because it was a great salvation, it was all the plan of God, and it wasn't you that sent me, but it was God, and it was for a wonderful salvation. To the contrary, there's no evidence at all that he ever takes any revenge against them, never even gives them an argument at all. He goes out of his way to try to reassure them that they have nothing to fear. Yet in these few words, where he seems to be asking a simple question, the rabbis say this was a rebuke. The rest, you know, then the brothers finally recuperate, and he convinces them that they should all come down to Egypt and to go back and tell father that everything you've seen and the power that I have. Because Yosef knew that the next phase, there was no way he could save the family. This is parenthetical, because many people wonder, why did Yosef bring the family down to Egypt in the first place? Why not keep them in Canaan? And the answer to that seems to me to be pretty obvious, because the story goes on to describe the extent of the famine. And the Egyptians had to sell virtually, they sold all their animals, and they had to give up their land. And then he resettled them, and he set up a system where he taxed them one-fifth, and they kept four-fifths. So you see the extent of the poverty. So it seems to me, as we told them, because there's 2 years into the famine and there's 5 years left to go, and there's not going to be any food. And so it seems to me that what he was telling them was that when it gets that bad, that everybody has to sell up all their property to get food, it's impossible to export food. How am I going to justify exporting food to a foreign country when the people here are starving? Technically, they wouldn't put up with. So you see the billions. However, if you come and you become part of the country, so then you're a citizen, you're entitled to food, just like everybody else. So Yosef knew that would be happening, and therefore there was no other way. That's why he says, God sent me before you as a salvation. If I wasn't in this position now, you'd starve to death. Because there's no way I can export food under the circumstances. So then they accept it, and they come back, and they tell Yaakov. Let's take a look at the reaction of Yaakov. On Memhei, that's 45:26, Chavav. And this is when they returned, and they told Yaakov, saying, O Yosef Chai, Yosef is still alive. V'chihu Moshiel b'chol Eretz Yisrael, and he's the ruler of all of Egypt. V'yafag libo kilohem in lahem. And his heart turned away. V'yafag libo v'halach v'lahamim. He just turned away. He refused to believe him. His heart wouldn't accept it. He rejected it. He wouldn't accept it. Because he didn't believe them. Now that's a very strange kind of a reaction. Why would he react in that way? Why would he simply refuse to listen to what they had to say? You would have thought just the opposite. He of all people would have the greatest reason to embrace the news. It's not the reaction we're expecting. The first time you read it, and they're going back, and you're awaiting this tremendous, this is great. Everybody would like to be the bearer of such news, but then you must be disappointed when it's not that he didn't believe it, he refused to listen. He turned away from it. Then Vayidavru Eliv is called Divayed, they had to really work on him. They had to convince him. And they told him all the words of Yosef that he had said to them, Vayaras Argolos. And he saw the wagons. There's an inference over there. The wagons refer to the wagons that Paro had given. Paro underwrote the journey, the cost of the transportation. He sent all the wagons to transport all their belongings. He said, don't worry, Don't worry about your belongings. Don't delay. And Rashi says that the Agalos also has a reference to the Torah they were studying, about Egla Rufa. They were studying the laws of the Egla, the heifer that has to be decapitated when there's a killer found between two cities and then an old killer. Is that it's a strange reaction. And what do you see from that reaction? Why would Yaakov react that way? To the contrary, if you put yourself in that psychological situation, usually you see parents of missing in actions, MIAs, they'll jump at any straw. It's usually the opposite. When there's something, a rumor, the slightest rumor, you jump on it and exaggerate the importance of it. To the contrary, here, when you have something really substantial, all the brothers came back, they weren't known to be liars, you have the opposite reaction. Take a look at the story of the when the brothers informed their father. Apparently they planned it out. They planned out all the different pieces over here, but there's something that they didn't anticipate. There was an unanticipated element, and that was the reaction of Yaakov. Take a look at chapter Lamed Zayin, that's 37. And they brought the garment, the Ksanas HaPasim, with blood, dipped in blood, torn up. And they said, this in Lamed Beis, they said, this is what we found. Hakerenah, please identify this. Is this the garment of your son or not? I don't know. I don't even think. This just sounds like a certain lack of sensitivity, just certain coldness in the way they present the whole thing to him. I could be wrong about that. That's just my take. Hakerenah, it's like identify the this garment. This is in Perek Lamed Ches, Pasuk Chafei. She was taken out to be killed because he thought that she was an adulteress. And she sent to her father-in-law saying, to the man to whom this belongs, she wouldn't embarrass him publicly. Because I'll say, better to die in the Kivshan Eish, in the fiery furnace, than to embarrass another person publicly. To the one who owns these, I am pregnant. But Tomer, and she said, Akerna, identify with me. To whom are these objects? Exactly the same thing. So then the brothers presented this to Yaakov, and they asked him to identify, and he recognized him. He says, this is the garment of my son. A wild animal has eaten him. Yosef has been torn to bits. And Yaakov tore his garments, and he placed sackcloth on his loins, and he mourned for his son many days. So that's mourning. So the first phase is normal mourning, many days. And then all of his sons and daughters got up to comfort him, and he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down to the grave mourning over my son. And his father cried for him. Some say that's Yitzchak, Yitzchak was crying over the mourning of Yaakov. Now what is that? The brothers apparently, the family, or the daughters were not involved, but the brothers clearly did not anticipate. They knew, they had to know that this would cause him pain, but apparently they felt that they had no choice, as I tried to explain. They regarded Yosef at that time as being a danger and an enemy who wanted to enslave them. But they did not have the ability to understand the consequences this would have for Yaakov. And Yaakov, what does that mean? He refused to be comforted, and he said, I'll go down to my grave mourning. That's unusual, because mourning is a process. And Rashi mentioned the normal, because God has given us the capacity to forget, so to speak. You know, forget in the sense that you don't remember, but you go on with your life. Usually a year. After a year, a person overcomes. And then there's Yahrzeit. Once a year, you have Yahrzeit. But then a person has the ability to absorb it and to move on. What do you see from this? That's true in the ordinary case, but there's certain exceptions that it's simply a person can't accept it, can't accept it. He can't, Yaakov was unable to accept it. So he couldn't come to grips with it. Even a person like Yaakov. And you see interestingly enough, because it mentions, what does he have to say, a wild beast has devoured him? It's enough to say that, he says a wild beast has devoured him. Sorry, he says a wild beast has devoured him. Tara, he was cut to pieces. Why does he have to add he's cut to pieces? It's as though he has to obliterate this from his mind. There are people, sometimes a person is able, can sustain a loss, but they have to obliterate it. You see, there are sometimes a person can come to peace with it, and they have the memory, no matter how they go through the pain, and they have the memory, and they don't deny that they had a child, and they remember it with fondness, and they can accept it, and they move on. They go and find a substitute, perhaps, or whatever. Apparently, Yaakov couldn't do that. He simply obliterated it from his mind. He had to uproot the entire thing from his mind. And there's a price to be paid, though. Sometimes that's the only way. The price is that you're never going to be the same. You lose. You see, he's always in a state of mourning, and Chazal say that he didn't have Ruach HaKodesh. The Ruach HaKodesh is like a form of Nevuah. That means to say when a person, because a person can only experience prophecy, prophetic insight, when he's functioning in the highest possible level. That means they even have to play music. And you see, Yitzchak, before he gave the brachas, had to have the meal, because a person, in order for a person, that's why, by the way, that's the fundamental why Yadis does maintain that a person has an obligation to maintain his health. If people think it's health for this, for the sake of health. It's not for the sake of health, per se. It's only because the service of God demands a person has to have all his energies at the ready, and if a person is sick, if he's not in the best possible physical state, so then his mental energies can't be devoted to the task of serving God. He can't be involved in learning to the highest possible level. And that's why if a person is depressed, a person is obligated to take care of his mental health, because when a person is in a bad mental state, the person can't really be creative. Can't be involved in growth, can't be involved in learning, can't be involved in knowledge. It's interesting, the Torah demands that a person be in a healthy physical state, in a healthy psychological state, of course, to the best of one's ability, obviously. There are certain things beyond your control. But to the extent that you're not taking care of yourself, you're not in line with the will, you're not following God's will. That's a mitzvah. This is something that Yaakov had no control over. There are certain things that we just have no control over. That's on his sorrows, the hidden things. Sometimes a person can sustain, and even a person like Yaakov can sustain a loss that is just too devastating, and you just have to withdraw from it. And when you withdraw from it, there is a certain loss. It doesn't mean that he stopped living. Don't put it that way. I don't believe that. But it meant that he continued learning. He did go on, but if something is lost, it's not the same. The pasuk itself testifies to this. Let me just explain, you are all on the right track. You see, that's why when a person has that type of a reaction to a loss, they have to distance themselves from the entire thing. They have to withdraw from the entire thing. And that's why he couldn't turn his heart back to, he couldn't get back in love. It's too painful. Because if I allow myself to have hope, to go through that, and to have to re-experience that all over again, there's a risk. If you could put yourself in the position of a parent with an MIA and they've gone through a number of these rumors and they didn't, you can't go through it anymore. Because every time you get back into it, there's a risk. You're exposing yourself once again. You see, you're letting hope. Hope means you're reestablishing the attachment. You're reestablishing the attachment and you're agreeing to accept the possibility that maybe it'll come true. Well, I guess a lot of people have been burnt in relationships even. That's it. They give up on relationships. There are people like that. That's it. They've had enough of it. They had enough of it because it's too painful. I just don't want to go through that pain. You have to have a certain amount of hope. Every time you get involved in any kind of a relationship, you're exposing yourself to hurt. But that's part of life. I mean, a person that would say, look, I'm not going to get involved in relationships because I can get hurt. Or I'm not going to have any friends because they could die and then I'll be unhappy. I mean, we all recognize that's absurd. Life carries that risk. In this case, however, Yaakov's initial reaction indicates the state that he was in. That's it. The only way I was able to deal with this is by completely turning away from it. I cannot have anything to do with it. I can't look at any pictures. I have to act as though there was never a Yosef in the world. That's it. That's indicated by his first reaction. Then they worked on him. You see, I had to work on him and prove, and when he was finally convinced, then what does the word say? Vatechi ruach Yaakov aviha. That's the pasuk. This is not a medrash. The spirit of Yaakov came back to life. That means in a certain sense that he was dead. That's the plain shot. Rashi says, ruach, ruach HaKodesh. That is to say, now, I don't want anyone to have the idea that Yaakov Avinu was an individual who was walking around like a dead man. That's not the case. It's all relative to the level that he could have been on. But to a certain extent, there was an element of death. He'd been destroyed. Because that, in order, as I said, in order for a person to be involved, fully involved, he's got to be happy. He's got to have his energy. He's got to have his energy. And sometimes people have pains in their lives and losses. They'll go on learning. They'll still teach. It's just not the same, though. Because a certain amount of energy is being withdrawn. And he had withdrawn a certain amount of energy from life. And Yosef understood his father. Yosef understood his father. He understood the closeness in a way that they didn't understand. Maybe they didn't. They denied it. Because this was a surprise to them. In all that they had done, they never calculated, and you can understand why they never calculated, because they blamed Yaakov. They blamed him for his favoritism of Yosef. And therefore, that came out. What they did was not a deliberate, conscious attack against Yaakov. It was directed against Yosef, but there was an element, of course, of hostility against Yaakov as well. And you can even see it by the way they just throw him the coat. And then, as I said, the proof that they didn't anticipate it is to be seen in the fact that they tried to comfort him. Now, they wanted to comfort him. They couldn't tell him the truth, but they assumed that he'd be comforted and they'd go on. And that indicated that they could not anticipate. They didn't understand the nature of the relationship. But Yosef did. And there was one element that had to be dealt with. So I maintain, and I think that that's what Debbie was referring to before, when Yosef said, Ha'od Avichai, he meant it as a question. He was asking a question. And before I explain it, I just want to show you that the point that he's making over here is a very important point. Because we have a different concept of life. There's an important lesson for all of us that we can learn from this. The Jews are always into this thing about life, you know. L'chaim, to life. You know, the whole world has this impression that, you know, we value life as more important than anything about life. It's always big with this, you know, Jews don't give $18, they give chai. Yeah, right? They don't give 36, they give twice chai. Everything is, you know, to the point where it's almost like a superstitious kind of thing. But what is the value of life? Of course, it's all true. We do value life. But I think that sometimes people don't even think about what do you mean by life. They just take physical existence per se. That's it, just to keep living. As though it's some type of a physical immortality, which is not realistic. There's a very fascinating halacha to show you that this point, that when we speak about life, we're not talking about physical existence. Per se, that's part of it, of course, but that's not what that itself we don't regard as life. Interestingly enough, the rabbis say that tzaddikim b'mishasam kruim chayim, that the righteous in death are alive, and the evil people, while they're alive, are called dead. They don't experience true life because that's just a life. It's an animalistic type of life. It's not real life. There's a halacha in Hilchos Rotzeach Ushmiras HaNefesh, laws of murderers. It's about Oy Miklat, the city of refuge. You know the halacha, that if somebody kills somebody, b'shogeg, accidentally, but the accident has to be a certain degree of negligence. So the person should have been more careful. It displays a negligence about human life, like a person just throwing a chopping wood, throwing rocks in a place where he knows there are people there. He doesn't intend specifically to kill anybody, but he knows that he should be more careful. So therefore he has to go to the city of refuge and live there until the death of the Kohen Gadol. And if he leaves, then he's liable to the death penalty. He can be executed. But as long as he stays there, in exile. That's his punishment, exile. So now listen to the Rambam. The Rambam says like this. Talmud shet gola le'er miklat, a student who was exiled because he killed somebody by accident. So he's sentenced to exile. Magalin rabo imo. So they exile his Rebbe with him. His Rebbe has to go with him. Says, what's the reason for that? Well, let's just hold the same holds true the opposite. If the Rebbe is, the Rebbe gives a sentence to Eremik, what then the students are exiled after him. What? The reason is because it states in the Pasuk that we send them to the city of Resh Vachai, and he lives there. That is, he's not killed, Vachai, he lives. But the law that we learn out is that he has to be provided with all the necessities of life. I say lo kedei sheyichya. The Pasuk is saying that you have to provide for him the base for the necessities. Vachai balei chachma, and the life of people of chachma, umavaksha, those who search for chachma, below Talmud Torah, without Torah, kamisa chashuvin is considered death. So that's the Pasuk. This is not just an abstract idea, it's a halacha. That is to say, the Beis Din in exiling him is obligated to provide him with all the necessities of life, and for a Talmud Chacham, for someone who studies Torah, if you don't provide him with Torah, then that's not life. He's like dead, he's dead. That's the idea over here. So Yosef, when he said, Aod Avichai, in my opinion, he knew that he was physically alive. But he also knew Yaakov Avinu better than any one of them. And he knew the closeness of the relationship. And he understood psychology. And he knew the tremendous danger that they had subjected him to put him in such a state where he'd basically withdraw. He wouldn't be alive anymore. He wouldn't be alive anymore. And therefore, in a spiritual sense, he could have been destroyed. So that's what he wanted to know. Ha'od Avichai, my father. What I'm talking about now is not the physical. Is he still my father? The person that I used to learn with? The person that shared all the knowledge with me? Or is his personality so changed that's it? He's withdrawn into himself? He's withdrawn into himself and it's never going to be the same anymore. I don't have a father anymore. When the rabbis say that this was a rebuke to the brothers, that's what they mean. They mean that it was a rebuke because by asking that question, he was pointing out to them the seriousness of what they had done, that just they had never considered. That's the reaction on that level, nifalu mipara. But at first they were in a state of shock. It first dawned on them that element of their action, what they had done. That was, you might call, an unintended consequence. That wasn't the purpose. The purpose was not to destroy Yaakov spiritually or psychologically, but he was pointing out to them that you see, when you act irrationally, when you're involved in sin, there are many, many consequences. And the consequence over here, that's what he wanted to know. He wanted to know not if he was physically alive. He knew that already. There's no question he knew that. That was the whole idea of the accusation, to see whether Yehuda would plead for Binyamin so that he could save the father. That he knew he was alive. But he wanted to know a different dimension, whether he was alive as the father that he had once known before, whether he was still that same person, whether he would still be able to have that same relationship. Or had they put him in a position where he had to withdraw so completely? And some, there are people that do that. They just withdraw under the pain is too great. They withdraw from life. There is such a phenomenon. I mean, I'm exaggerating it because I'm not saying that that's what happened to Yaakov. With Yaakov, it's a matter of degree, and that's what he was concerned about. But that phenomenon is something which happens, that people sometimes experience certain things that are so painful. I mean, this is, in a sense, I think you'll find it even among veterans, war veterans that are Vietnam, or there's a certain syndrome where people have been experienced such painful experiences in war that they, traumatic, it's a very traumatic syndrome. Post-traumatic stress syndrome. Yeah. The people can be exposed to things that are so intolerable to them, they're not prepared for it. and usually the brutality of war is such that they simply withdraw. They did have this phenomenon. The books I read about the Holocaust, that people reacted differently. They were stronger and weaker. Some people, for example, in Auschwitz, the average lifespan was 3 months before they would die just from the beating and the malnutrition and disease. And then there were strong ones that survived. But then, all the books write, there was a group of people, for some reason or other, they called them Muslimmänner in German. That means, it translates into Muslims. They called them the Muslims. These are like the walking dead. These are people that were just destroyed psychologically, and they were just like walking around, shocked. And they would, some of them would just try and get to the fences, or the fences were electric. They would electrocute themselves. Others were just walking around in a daze. They knew that they were just they'd be dead in no time. They could not continue. They were in a state of complete shock and withdrawal. They simply withdrew. It was too intolerable to accept. So that phenomenon does occur. So I think that is the shot, that there's a message here of the Yom HaDin. And I think we all can learn from this. And that is to say that we don't always consider the full consequences. Of course we consider, because we're close in terms of our own emotions, and we're, you know, our main focus is on how things affect us emotionally. And when we act towards other people, we don't take into consideration all of the consequences, and we tend to minimize. That's something that I think would be a good lesson for everybody to learn. You see it always in relationships. The person always, generally speaking, when people get into a rift, an argument, and one person feels, look at everything I did for you, and then, yeah, well, what about the things I did for you? You see, it's yeah, but those things weren't that significant. You know, that, you know, you were going there anyway. In other words, a person always tends to maximize. A person always tends to overestimate the things that they do for others and to minimize the things that others do for them. That's where they're. So you see that mechanism. And a person always tends to minimize the negative effects. Like, I was only kidding, I was just joking, and so on. But if somebody, how can you say that? Don't you know my feelings? You know I'm sad. But I was just joking. Yeah, but you could joke. But what? But it sends my sensitivity. You're not sensitive. So the point is like this, that we have a different attitude towards our own feelings than we do to somebody else. We're very protective of ourselves and our own feelings, and do not have that same, you know, sensitivity to other people. So there's a lesson to be learned here, and that is that we should try and be just, and of course, that's v'ahavta le'recha kamocha. And we should never assume that our feelings are different. If it bothers you, put yourself in the other person's position. If it's something that would bother you, then you should assume that it would bother him. If it's something that doesn't bother you, do not assume that it won't bother him. That's a bad barometer. You thought I was going to go both ways. It doesn't go both ways. If anything, you should be more solicitous of somebody else's feelings, because your own feelings, you know. So you could be emotional on your own feelings. But you don't have to assume that the other person should be emotional just because you are. There's another false barometer that we use. We assume, when you say, I was just joking, it's ridiculous. Why is that person so, you're so sensitive? Well, it's not that the person is so sensitive, it's the point is that you're projecting, you're assuming that since it doesn't bother you, that the other person should react the same way emotionally. But that person may be in a totally different... You see, it's easy to identify. You'll see. You're solicitous of those things. You'll be sympathetic to other people when a person comes with a certain complaint. You're more sympathetic if that's the kind of thing that would bother you, if you share that emotion. You'll notice that. Two people can come to you. One person come to you, and it just doesn't arouse the same sympathy. It could be that person's issue is more significant, but it doesn't arouse the same thing. Because to you, that's trivial. Or you've gotten over that, and it's no big deal. And some, you say, you'll have much more sympathy if you were in school and that kind of thing. You all said we're shy. You all said that thing. You can identify with it. So you see yourself in that child, so you'll be more solicitous. But what if the kind of thing that was no big deal for you, but for this kid it's very difficult? You say, come on, what is your problem? Why can't you just go out there, get on the ice and start skating so you'll fall down? Big deal. You see? Because if that's the way you are, if you had that kind of guts or pluck, whatever it was, and it didn't bother you, so then that's the attitude you take to others. So we always operate towards others in a very self-centered kind of a way. Which is, I mean, all right, maybe for starters, but you got to get beyond that. If you want to be helpful to people, you got to get beyond that, and you've got to have a respect, a genuine respect for the emotions, weaknesses, sensitivities of others, even if you don't share them. That's an important lesson. The brothers didn't answer. The brothers did not answer the question. Yosef didn't ask for it. And you see the brilliance of Yosef. The brilliance. He was so considerate of them. He was so considerate in the way he got the point across. It was just enough to call their attention. It was enough. He operated with a subtle way. And you can even agree with those commentators that said that he said it, "Is my father still alive?" He could have said it in that tone, but they got the point. He communicated that point to them in a way that they would just accept it, and he didn't, there was no need for an answer. He just wanted to make them aware of it. And they learned the lesson. This way, let's put it this way. He stated the question. He stated the question, and if they would have answered him, they would have answered him. I can't go into Yosef's mind and say that, you know, I don't know everything that he was anticipating. We all, our task is to interpret the question. That's it. They couldn't answer, so he proceeded. He proceeded.
The answer was not really critical, because when he saw his father...
It was sort of a subtle rebuke. If they would have answered the question, fine. Apparently they couldn't answer the question. That's why Yosef proceeded. He proceeded. He didn't want to lose them. He didn't want to lose them, and he brought them close to him. And he didn't want them to be overwhelmed by what happened.